let's meditate first, and I will give a little bit of coaching, and then we'll sit. Again, you can do any kind of meditation you would like to do in these 10 minutes. This is just suggestion. What I'm talking about is mindfulness. Laura. Again, if you haven't signed in, come do so at some point. So the first instruction I gave about mindfulness is I said, don't do anything. Just sit down. Open up to whatever is happening and become aware of your breathing. The only operation you do in mindfulness is you bring attention to your breathing. Now, attention won't stay on your breathing. It will go wherever it goes. You just bring it back to your breathing. So that was the first instruction I gave. And the second instruction I gave is, as you're sitting there doing nothing and just feeling yourself breathe, let yourself soften and open. Let your head soften and open so your thoughts can flow easily. Let your heart and your body soften and open so your feelings can flow easily. Let your body soften and open so sensations can come into you and through you easily. So far we've got sit down, do nothing, feel your breathing, soften and open. Then I said, maybe you would like to pay a little closer attention to what is happening. It's as though you're the sky, and the things that are happening are the weather, the clouds, the sun, the sunbeams, the rainbows. So what are those things? Those things are thoughts, feelings, and sensations. That's what occurs to you as you sit and you pay attention. To make those things more clear to you, I gave you a focusing technique. I said you can sub-vocally label those things. That is, without speaking, you can, in your mind, say thought, lip, ear, hearing, breathing, shoulder, thinking, feeling, thinking, breathing. So you can call out to yourself for a minute or two what you're experiencing. It's like focusing a lens. And then you stop doing that and you just sit and you breathe and you open and you notice. That's pretty much all the instruction. I will certainly have other things to kind of tune you, but that's kind of the basis of it. Today what I want to talk about is changing where you're coming from. Changing where your energy is gathered. Typically, we're very up and forward in this culture. Up in our heads, and we're forward of where we are. You know, we walk around like this. You watch people walk around, their heads are forward, and, you know, they're kind of up. So it's kind of like your body is it's like a carriage for your head. You know, it has no utility except it kind of pumps blood up to your, it serves your head. But other cultures have felt differently about that. I am told that the ancient Greeks felt that the heart was the center of the person. And in much Oriental philosophy, the Hada or the Hara or the Dantien that we talked about last week, just below the navel is the center of the person. So by directing attention to your breathing, you bring energy, you bring your sense of where you are out of exclusively being in your head, and you re-inhabit your body. So where you're coming from in life is you're coming not only from your thoughts, you're coming from your full being. It's a full-bodied experience of life. Many of you have heard the expression, where your attention goes, your energy flows. If your attention is always going in the dominant hemisphere of your brain, then your energy is all kind of cathected, is stuck up there. But if you keep coming down to your breathing, it's as though you redistribute your energy. It's more than as though you redistribute your energy in your whole being. So you feel your breathing, and you're coming from your entire being, not this. And the way you do that is not by thinking, I want my energy to go down there. That brings energy up here. The way to do that is by changing what you pay attention to. So it's not a question of wrestling with your thoughts. It's a question of paying attention to something other than thinking. That turns out not to be so easy because thought is such a habit that it follows you, your attention, wherever it goes. You're feeling your breathing and you're commenting on, oh, I'm feeling my breathing. There's my, you know. So it's at least attention is coming to a more full body. At least your thoughts are kind of following your attention, even if they're not separate from your attention. Eventually, what you want is a very clean separation between attention and thought. Attention is what is the sky, what is your basic nature. And thought is something that happens within the sky. And it's clearer than the nose on your face, because you can't see the nose on your face. Ken Wilber used to say, it's clearer than the nose on your face. What's happening here? But when you first start doing this, it's not clear. Thought and attention are kind of all bound together. And it's just by practicing bringing attention elsewhere than thought that thought and attention separate. Which is really very useful, because when thought is productive, it's great to have it. When it's not productive, it's really good to be able to kind of re-identify yourself as other than your thoughts. So I'll wait till everybody gets settled, and we'll sit. Say yeah. I'll do it. Yeah, I'll tie it in a minute.
I thought you were going to trip on me.
Thank you. Okay, so, is everybody settled, sort of? So in these 10 minutes, and it will be approximate because I can't see the clock. In these 10 minutes, find your breathing and create space. Allow the boundaries of your body to kind of, the borders of your body to kind of dissolve outward. So that it's like you're a hollow breathing being. It's almost like you're not even there. There's just breathing and awareness. And thoughts can come right through. Feelings can come right through. Sensations can come right through. You just breathe and open. I'm going to ring the chime in 1 minute. So if you're lost in thought, take this minute to come back to your breathing. Could have had an audio recording of that. That was as quiet as 80-some people ever are going to get. That was remarkable. I mean, usually there, we, you know, you have to shuffle around a little bit or you cough or something. There was kind of nothing. It was just absolutely silent. Really amazing. Gary.
I thought your instruction this morning about shifting attention was very helpful, and that was a new one, I think.
Yeah.
Any further thoughts about how to be in that witness possible?
How to be in that?
You're stepping back and looking at you and the sky.
Witness, he said.
Witness.
Yeah, I hear. I was listening to where he was coming from, and he was trying to understand it with his thoughts. Now, how do I create this witnessing of me and the sky? That's a mental image that you're trying to form. All I said was, bring your attention to your breathing. Just keep coming back to your breathing. And this witnessing perspective will emerge by itself. You don't make the witness happen. You come to your breathing, and then something takes you away from your breathing, and you realize, oh my God, I forgot my breathing. You come back. And then you kind of start to make a distinction between being present with your breathing and getting caught up in something. And then after a while more, you can hear the thing that would catch you up, the thought. But you stay attentive to your breathing, and then the thought crosses your mind, and you go, oh my God, that's a thought. I'm watching that thought. But at first, the thought takes you away, and when you come back, you realize there's a distinction between breathing and noticing, like you're doing now, and thinking, which takes you away from your breathing and from being present. So the first way that you start witnessing is you start witnessing the lacunae. Is that how you say it? The gaps in your awareness of your breathing, because you get sucked into thought for a little while. Like when I said 1 minute to go, a lot of you went, oh, oh, that's right, where's my breathing? Because you were lost in thought. And then, so there comes a distinction between being present, and your breathing is one thing that's happening at present, and the things that take you out of presence into some sort of absorption. And at first you don't know what those, you can't witness those are just things that take you away. But you can make a distinction between being here and being away. And after a while, you can stay here and you can notice those things that would have taken you away. But you don't try to make that happen. You just come back to your breathing and notice when you get not, when you get absorbed. Or you notice when you come back from being absorbed. Being absorbed is a form of unconsciousness. All right, we continue. A couple of quick announcements, and then we got to get out of that birth canal. Okay. Right, so Mind Supermind is tonight, 7:30 at the Schott Center Auditorium, right here. Okay. Jim Kwako is going to talk about heaven as a state of mind potentially available to you at present. Okay. Higher states of consciousness that are actually within you, okay, available to you. And that's at $6. And if you haven't registered in advance, I think you can do so at the door. Though it's getting pretty full, I think. CDs. There are 5 CDs for Lynn here. 2 of them are Peter's wonderful past life presentation. So if anybody would like those, raise your hand. Okay, first two hands I saw.
And I'll be putting them up.
Okay, these guys were the first two, I'm sorry. Trudy gets one and Randy
gets
one.
That's already up. Actually, it's already up.
And they're already, yeah, and Chris is already on his website.
Okay.
Let's see. Did you... 2 on last week's Unconditional Love Qigong session.
Can I have one of them?
Laura and Chris. Okay. So Laura, come get this, okay?
You want to
watch me? You got to watch. They make you watch. Thank you. And last one is class 4 of this class, which was class 4 was probably BPM 3, I'm guessing. 5, 6, yeah. So BPM 3, Mary was the first hand I saw, and I'm sorry. These are all on the website, swt.org/Spencer. Thanks to Robert.
And Michael.
No, next week's the last day of class, right?
I'm going to announce that in a minute, okay?
Right.
Okay, so next week is the last class of this term for this class. In the winter, I have some actually good news that would have been bad news previously, but is now good news. We will have an 8-week session in the winter. It'll be $60 again. It'll be an hour and a half official session. And it will be in the auditorium. Now, the difference is now the auditorium has a projector and a great big screen, a full sound system, so we can see stuff really professional big. Whiteboards so that we can write and you can actually see the board. And except for the first week it'll be auditorium style seating. That is just seats. But after the first week, they promised me, I hope that it will actually manifest, that there will be tables as well as chairs. So the auditorium will be set up with tables and chairs, which is the best of all worlds, okay?
So
we can increase the capacity. Not too much. We can increase the capacity from 80 to 100.
Well, that's good.
But that's good. That's good.
Yeah, I like that room. It's very bright.
Yeah, it's a bright, lovely room. So that's what's going to happen in the winter. I don't know when it starts.
Registration?
Like third week in January, something like that.
Do you know when registration?
I don't know any of that stuff.
What's the name of the subject this time?
The title.
Yeah.
Consciousness class.
All right.
It's always consciousness class. Okay,
no,
so.
No,
it used to be called the lead. All right, so we gotta do this. Come on. We got a lot of ground.
Well, it's still Friday, right?
It's still Friday. It's 10 to 11:30.
Okay, wait. Yeah. Spend it, yeah. You may want to tell them not to have that giant lawnmower for 2 hours right outside the window. We couldn't hear a thing. They could time their mowing.
They mow the lawn.
Okay, I will, because I'm going to be talking to those guys about how to work all that stuff, I will do that. Okay. Let me write it down.
No lawnmower.
Next to auditorium. All right. Okay, Julie, one more announcement really quickly, then we got to do that.
Well, next Saturday we change our clocks behind daylight
ends
on November 1st.
Okay, so next Saturday it's not daylight savings time anymore. I refuse. It's dark too early. I'm not doing it.
Dark.
Stupid. All right. Anyway. All right. So here we go. Where we have been so far, and then we'll go where we're going. Okay, so where we have been so far, extremely briefly, is we've visited three phases of the birth process. The first basic perinatal matrix is the one in which the fetus is in the womb and all the needs are satisfied. So I would call that the basic substrate would be bliss. And lack of individuation. There's no need for a self separate from the environment because the environment is providing everything automatically. So it's oneness or bliss. But what happens is that paradise comes to an end because of the birth process. And the second basic perinatal matrix, phase of the birth, is the contraction of the womb without the cervix yet being opened. And that's when the world kind of closes in on one. And the basic substrate that we're talking about there is victimization. That's hell. No exit, all inimical force. In later life, this is the basic substrate of feeling paranoid or like a victim. Third phase of the birth process is when the fetus and the mother together are struggling to bring the birth about, when the baby is moving down the birth canal. And that in later life is that forms the basis in later life of the idea that life is a struggle. So if life is a paradise, and then life becomes hell, and then life becomes a struggle to find okayness. So that's the third perinatal matrix, and now we're going to the fourth perinatal matrix, which is the substrate of life lived in a different of individuated happiness, if you will. If the first perinatal matrix is happiness as a unity with everything, the fourth perinatal matrix is happiness as a separate entity interacting with everything. Another way to say the fourth perinatal matrix is it's life as adventure. So the substrates are life as being in bed, going to sleep with everything okay, to being a victim in life, to having to struggle because life is such a struggle, to life as a dance, an adventure. Let me say one more thing, Macklin. So last night in the middle of the night, I thought, I have to explain why we're doing this birth stuff. Otherwise, it's just kind of unconscious birth stuff. So I asked myself the question. I'm going to quote myself because I don't want to. In the middle of the night, you're very clear. What good is more consciousness of the structure of our personality? What good is more consciousness of the structure of our personality? Yeah, maybe deep in my unconscious, there's memory of the birth. Why do I care about that? Because it helps us to understand what we're experiencing. That is, if there are these frameworks that are the basis of our personality, then it helps us to understand, oh, I'm in victim framework now. Okay, it is resonating all the way back to my birth and maybe to my past lives and maybe to the archetypes that I, you know, that everything is going wrong and that it's hopeless for me. When you get stuck in that, it's really helpful to understand, oh, that's a a way of looking that I am caught in right now. It's not truth, it's a particular perspective. So it helps us to understand what we're experiencing, to keep it in perspective, as to realize that even though right now life seems like such a hell of a struggle, and my whole theme of life, my whole life, it's been such a struggle, that's just probably because I had a hell of a time in that third perinatal matrix, and it kind of dominates my personality. But now that I understand a little bit more about how personality is formed, and what the, then I realize that this is just kind of my bias. And the third thing it does is it helps us to realize alternatives. As it helps us to realize, even though I tend to see life as hopeless or as a struggle or as it's all cool, everything's just going to come to me, you know, that there are other possibilities. And I can entertain those other possibilities because all of us had a birth. Some of these matrices may have been more accentuated or attenuated, but we all had a birth, right? And so we all have these possibilities pregnant within us. So it helps us to realize that we have choice. Choice is what we're looking for in growth, right? In psychotherapy and growth. We're looking for the fact that people get out of unconsciously being stuck, become conscious of how they're stuck, and then realize that there are other alternatives to the stuckness. So that's what we're doing, is we're kind of looking at the deepest level at the structure of personality, or at least one possibility for the deepest level of the structure of personality, so that we can get unstuck when we're stuck. So if we're stuck right there, right now, in the birth canal, let's get unstuck, okay? Let's find out what happens in the successful delivery. This is not a terribly long exposition, so I think we'll do it perfectly. We'll get out today. Okay. Again, I'm reading from the Holotropic Mind. All right. Mike, you might want to put this.
Oh, that's his. Mine is over there.
Oh. You might want to put this a little somewhere else because I'm going to be right next to it. If somebody is recording this, you might want to put it over there because A, I'll knock it off, and B, it'll be too loud.
No problem.
Okay, here we go. Okay. Macklin, yeah.
Yay. How are you along with the fourth part that you were just giving us? I think that stuff is the worst way because I am quite sure that I have impressions, bodily impressions, the ways of my thinking of that prior to my birth. I happen to know the situation my mother was caught in, and there was never any great exploration of that. But when I hear you talking, I think there's more to me, and my responses, my bodily responses out of that time within the so-called womb of protection, which there wasn't too much was going on outside. So she was very frightened and frightened for her life. I think I have interjected some of that.
Yeah, that's, I did mention that. I'll emphasize it a little more. Even Stan said that there, you know, in the good womb, there is the protection and nurturance. But there are influences, even in the good womb, that disturb that intrauterine existence. And in the so-called bad womb, which he did talk about, I didn't read very much of what he says about it, but can create lasting consequences. That is, if the mother was anxious, if there were a lot of teratogens coming through the placenta, if there were a lot of, you know, knocks or trauma happening, that will be reflected in actually, we know this, actually, the way that the brain is formed and wired, in at least in rats, you can plague the mothers, and then the rats come out all ready for fight or flight. Their brains are actually kind of structured differently. So it's now called pre- and perinatal psychology, And a lot of work has been done at extending BPM1 to all the possibilities pre and perinatally. Bill?
Really? I have a question.
Yeah.
The length of time that you spend in each stage, does that have more of an effect in your later life?
Supposedly.
If you were stuck in two, the paranoia, would you likely at a later in your life be more subject to paranoia or...
Yeah, again, we don't have a lot of data. It's very hard to get data on this, but as Carl and I have been talking about, we've been looking for it. I'm sure graduate students are looking for it all over the place. But yeah, the idea is if the cervix didn't open and there was a prolonged period in VPM2, there would be a tendency toward depression and paranoia, that kind of thing. Or if there was if various birth consequences supposedly underpin various current psychological states.
I'm confused.
Say it again?
One phase, don't you, the fetus die?
Oh, no.
The fetus doesn't die. The fetus just goes from being breathed by the mother to breathing on its own, if you will. Okay, the fetus comes from one world to another. But if the fetus dies, it's called
death.
That's not good. Okay. However, the experience of going from one world to another does involve a kind of death. So let me read for you. This section is called Death, Rebirth, and the Ego. As with the other three matrices, people reliving this last one often get in touch with very accurate details about their original birth experiences. Without previous intellectual knowledge of the circumstances of their delivery, people can discover that they were born with a forceps, or in the breech position, or with the umbilical cord wrapped around their neck. They can often recognize the type of anesthesia that was used during delivery. And not infrequently, they can relive in detail specific events that happened just after they were born. In many instances, we have the opportunity to verify the accuracy of such reports. All these things presumably have an effect. If the forceps had to be used, there's some feeling of I have to be rescued in my life, for example. Those of us who were born with anesthesia, maybe we think that when everything goes wrong, grab a pill. You know? I mean, there's a lot of possibilities here. Okay. BPM4 also has a distinct symbolic and spiritual dimension. Psychologically, the reliving of the moment of birth takes the form of the death-rebirth experience. The suffering and agony faced in BPM2 and BPM3 now culminate with ego death, an experience of total annihilation on all levels, physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. Ego death, total annihilation on all levels, physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. According to Freudian psychology, the ego is that part of us that allows us to correctly perceive external reality and function well in everyday life. People who have this concept of the ego frequently look upon the ego death as a frightening and tremendously negative event. That is, the ego is who I am. If I go through this ego death, it will obliterate me, as the loss of the ability to operate in the world. If I go through this, if I let myself experience this, I'll be a vegetable. However, what really dies in this process is that part of us that holds a basically paranoid view of ourselves and of the world around us. Now, this ego death process is a process that we approximate every time we meditate, every time we let go of ourselves into somebody else in love. Every time we have spiritual experience, a little bit of the usual framework of me here, this is who I am, dissolves away. There are levels of this experience. At the deepest level, it's obliteration. It's complete change. But at lesser levels, it's a lessening of the hegemony of the ego, of the usual way we look at things. Alan Watts called this aspect the me separate from everything else aspect. Me here, you there, we're separate. Okay. Alan Watts called this aspect, which involves a sense of absolute separateness from everything else, the skin-encapsulated ego. Right? That's what Watts called it. It is made up of the internal perception of our lives that we learn during the struggle through the birth canal and during various painful encounters after birth. So the ego comes into being with the birth process and with things that have happened to us after birth. In these early situations, the world seemed hostile to us, closing in around us, expelling us from the only life we have known and causing us emotional and physical pain. These experiences forged in us a false ego that continues to perceive the world as dangerous and carries this attitude over into future situations, even when the circumstances are radically different. The ego that dies in the fourth matrix in this process is identified with a compulsion to be always strong and in control, and to be constantly prepared for all possible dangers, even those we could never foresee and those that are purely imaginary. So our ideal as an ego is to be always strong, ever in control, and constantly prepared for all possibilities. That's the first birth. I think that's what they call original sin. You know, the idea that somehow coming into this world was loony. It created a misperception here somehow that we are struggling with, eventually are crucified by. It makes us feel that the circumstances are never right and that nothing is enough, okay? And that we have to pursue various grandiose projects to prove something to ourselves and others. The elimination of the false ego thus helps us to develop a more realistic image of the world and to build strategies of approaching it that are more appropriate and rewarding. The experience of the ego death, marking the transition between BPM 3 and BPM 4, is usually dramatic and catastrophic. This is in non-ordinary states of consciousness when people are going through this. Even in meditation, a non-ordinary states of consciousness, there comes a point in one's meditation practice when one feels like one is dying. And that's written about in the literature, and you go find somebody that's been through that. Then you don't find me to kind of like tell you to breathe, and you find out, you know, what happens when I really am coming apart here. Then you find a guru, somebody that has been through that, presumably. Gary, and then Raven.
So does this death rebirth happen before the fetus is delivered?
It happens once when we're being delivered, okay? No, the birth happens when we're being delivered. The death rebirth happens at some later point, either when you're alive or supposedly when you die, okay? That is, if not before, when you die, you will go through another, you'll get through a death and a rebirth, okay? And as Peter said, there's a literature called the Bardo literature about what happens as you go through this process. You know, that's the tunnel that comes. What is that tunnel? Birth tunnel. Okay, understand? Okay. Anyway. All right. The experience is in non-ordinary states of consciousness is usually dramatic and catastrophic. We may be bombarded with images from the past and present, and in evaluating them, we may feel that we've never done anything right and that we're absolute failures. So if you're having an experience of, I'm a total screw-up, I've never done anything right, I'm a total failure, you're close to a great realization and liberation. Let's see, Raven.
Could you talk more about original sin, how that ties in?
Various world religions, cultures, philosophies have said there's something wrong with the way that we are as we generally walk around. Somehow being born into this world has caused us to kind of misperceive the nature of things. Various philosophies or spiritual systems say different, give it a different spin. For example, in Christianity, it's good and evil. You know, we learned the distinction between good and evil, right? That's because we are a dualistic culture and we separate those two things. Other cultures would say we're born dukkha, off-center, if you will. Different ways to say it. But there's something about being born that causes us to kind of wrongly perceive the nature of things. Something that has to be learned.
Spitz.
Yeah.
I understand the psychological framework as an aid, but it seems like to me the birth process is a net from an evolutionary point of view. The birth process is natural. I don't know exactly how to ask what I'm trying to ask, but it seems like you're taking cultural definitions of things and applying it to a natural process that we really don't understand yet because we're not mature as a species. It seems like you're taking the cultural framework of victimization and all of that and applying it to a natural process that has no such definition because we're not mature enough yet to really understand
human beings,
the wholeness of it.
Yeah, human beings are, that's what Stan and Rick Tarnas after him says so well, is human beings are in a birth process. We're collectively in a process of death and rebirth. And as we complete this process, as consciousness moves through this process on a general level, we will we will see things in a different way. We'll see the whole process. We'll appreciate all the parts of the process and how they're necessary. And we'll see how the process resolves because we will have come through it on a collective level.
But I think we can do that right now.
Yeah, well, everybody that does that right now helps the world to come through. I mean, that's what we're doing, is we're kind of moving ourselves through this. I got to keep going, okay? These are all good questions, but I want to kind of get us to the good part. Okay? I want to get us to the good part. We're still, you know... Right. We're convinced... Now, we're going through the last part of the delivery. Okay? We're convinced that we're pitiful and powerless, and that nothing we might think or do will change our desperate situation. Our entire world seems to collapse, and we lose all meaningful reference points in our lives. Personal accomplishments, loved ones, support systems, hopes and dreams all seem for naught. The route to freedom from the despair and helplessness we feel. Okay, so here's either we're physically dying and we lose all reference points, or we're at some point in our lives when we touch this and we seem to lose all the things that we held to. The route to freedom from the despair and helplessness we feel, not just about the birth process, but period, the route to freedom from the despair and helplessness we feel is through surrender, the very thing our egos are fighting. The experience of total personal surrender is a necessary prerequisite for connecting with a transpersonal source. Yes. That's their way of saying God. Okay. A transpersonal source. Recovering alcoholics and addicts know this place as the moment when one admits complete powerlessness and discovers the higher power. Yes. So here we are at the bottom. We have to go, oh God, and surrender. After we have hit bottom, we are suddenly struck by visions of blinding white or golden light, of supernatural radiance and beauty. This, remember Eckhart Tolle at the very beginning of The Power of Now, 5 minutes into it, in his thick German accent, talking about, I couldn't go on anymore at the point of suicide,
yeah,
at the point
of,
you know.
Here if you want to play.
No, it's okay. I remember it very well. I can't go on anymore. At the point of suicide, he realizes that he can't live with himself anymore. And then he realizes that the himself he thought he was isn't the self. There's two selves. The one that can't live with the one that he thought he was. And he said, I woke up and I never seen, it was like sunlight. I'd never seen it before. It was so brilliant. He spent 6 months apparently on a park bench pretty much just. All right. We're suddenly struck by visions of blinding white or golden light, of supernatural radiance and beauty. There's a feeling of space expanding around us. And we're filled to overflowing with a sense of liberation, redemption, salvation, and forgiveness. We feel purged as if we've just been released from all the heaviness of our lives. Guilt, aggression, anxiety, and all other forms of difficult emotions seem to fall away. We may feel overwhelming love for our fellow humans, deep appreciation for the warmth of human contact, solidarity with all life, and a sense of oneness with nature and the universe. The arrogance and defensiveness tend to fade away as we discover the power of humility, perhaps promoting us to be of service to others. Exaggerated ambition, as well as cravings for material wealth, status, and power, suddenly seem childish, absurd, and useless vanities. I'm going to go on, okay, because a little more I want to read to you. The spiritual and mythological symbolism associated with BPM 4 is abundant and varied, and as with the other matrices, the imagery can draw from virtually any cultural tradition. The ego death can be experienced as being sacrificed to the terrifying Indian goddess Kali, or the Aztec sun god Huitzilopochtli. You somebody say it the way it should be. It's H-U-I.
Quetzal.
Say it.
I think the first part's Quetzal.
No, it's not Quetzalcoatl. No, Quetzalcoatl. That's a different one. Okay. This is the Aztec sun god. Or one may feel also identified with a baby thrown by its mother into the devouring flames of the biblical Moloch, together with other children who have met their death in the immolation ritual. I have already mentioned the legendary bird Phoenix as an ancient symbol of rebirth. Visions of this mythological bird, or identification with it, are frequent occurrences in non-ordinary states. One can also experience spiritual rebirth as a union with specific deities, for example, the Aztec Quetzalcoatl, the Egyptian Osiris, or Adonis, Attis, and Dionysius from the Greek tradition. Identification with the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is amongst the most frequent experiential forms related to BPM-4, as illustrated. The bliss of this unexpected spiritual opening, abounding in astonishing insights, can be referred to as Promethean ecstasy. Okay. Occasionally, spiritual rebirth, and this can happen in any, you know, people go to the Grand Canyon and they have this experience. It happens. Sometimes people have this in sex. They have an experience of oneness with the universe and they go, wow. Occasionally, spiritual rebirth can be associated with a very special form of experience, the Atman-Brahman union described in ancient Hindu texts. Here the person feels a deep connection with the innermost spiritual core of his or her being. The illusion of the individual self fades away, and the person enjoys reunion with his or her divine self, Atman, who is also the universal self, Brahman. So the jiva is the individual self which fades away, and the person enjoys reunion with his or her divine self, Atman, who is also the universal self, Brahman, the cosmic source of all existence. This is a direct and immediate contact of the beyond within with God, or with what the Upanishads refer to as the Tat Tvam Asi, thou art that. This realization of the fundamental identity of the individual consciousness with the creative principle of the universe is one of the most profound experiences a human being can have. This is seeing God and being God. This is the full-blown mystical experience. Under the most ideal circumstances, the ego death and rebirth can have far-reaching and often lasting consequences. It frees us from the paranoid defensive posture toward the world It frees us from the paranoid defensive posture toward the world that we may have as the result of certain experiences of our birth and painful experiences thereafter. It is as if we have been stripped of the filters and distorting lenses that ordinarily limit our perception of ourselves and the world. Okay, I'll do it again. With the experience of rebirth, all our sensory pathways are suddenly wide open. Sights, sounds, smells, taste, and tactile sensations all appear to be unimaginably more intense, vivid, and pleasurable. We may feel that we're really seeing the world for the very first time in our lives. Everything around us, even the most ordinary and familiar scenes, seems unusually exciting and stimulating. People report entirely new ways of appreciating and enjoying their loved ones, the sound of music, the beauties of nature, and the endless pleasures that the world provides for our senses. And these things, this is pregnant within you, okay? This isn't something you have to have the full-blown mystical experience. This is something that you can touch at various, you do touch at various points in your lives when ordinary awareness deepens at some level and you suddenly have a deeper, fuller appreciation of things. Higher motivating forces, such as the pursuit of justice, the appreciation for harmony and beauty, and the desire to create it, a new tolerance and respect for others, as well as feelings of love, become increasingly important in our lives. Again, I didn't phrase that right, so let me phrase it. Higher motivating forces, such as the pursuit of justice, the appreciation for harmony and beauty, and the desire to create it, a new tolerance and respect for others, as well as feelings of love, become increasingly important in our lives. What is more, we perceive these as direct, natural, and logical expressions of our true nature and of the universal order. They cannot be explained in terms of psychological defenses, such as the Freudian reaction formation, that is appearing to be loving when we're actually feeling aggression and hatred, or of sublimation of the primitive instinctual drives, spending long hours helping others as a way to cope with our sexual tensions. He's saying Freud can't explain this away. It would be trying to push something huge into something little. Interestingly, there are striking parallels between these new awarenesses and what Abraham Maslow called meta-values and meta-motivations. He observed changes of this kind regularly in people who had spontaneous, mystical, or peak experiences. Positive after-effects of this kind are most intense during the days or weeks immediately following spiritual breakthroughs and tend to weaken with time. However, on a more subtle level, they leave a person permanently transformed. The individual who has successfully completed the death-rebirth sequence feels a sense of deep relaxation, quiet excitement, serenity, and inner peace. Let's have a couple questions. A couple questions that I need to read you. One more thing, then I need to show you a little bitty video.
What you're saying sounds an awful lot like the near-death experiences. So this sounds like he's talking about a virtual near-death experience that we have all had in this BPM-4 that we haven't been able to connect to. So when we read about other people's near-death experiences in the more physical world, and we have a resonance with it, maybe we're remembering that?
Yeah, what he's saying is near-death experiences animate the same dynamics that are stored in us of our birth. So there's the tunnel, there's the light, there's the music, there's the, you know, and people that have had those experiences are transformed. They live in a different way. They don't fear death anymore. They realize that death is an opening, not a closing. So in various experiences in our lives resonate at this level. That is, when we feel like there's no way out, we're a total failure, everything has gone wrong, you know, should we consider suicide? You know, that's BPM2 being dominating our awareness. We get stuck in that perspective, which is why you tell people that are suicidal, this is an experience you're having, it's a way you're looking at the world. Yes, you think you can never, you've always been like this, it'll always be like this, there's no way out of it. That's part of the experience. It's not predictive. It's just the way the experience is at this moment. You need to accept those feelings and look deeper, look further. So people need guidance in those states instead of getting drugged out of them and then they fall back into them. It's not a good thing. Gary, and maybe two more, and then we have to, I have to read something, and then we have to go further. Gary and then Mary.
So as I understand the way you're describing this, some people don't have these kinds of experiences, and therefore their rebirth would occur at their physical death.
Yeah, that's what's said.
But the other people who become bodhisattvas or otherwise enlightened, are they having rebirth here while they're still alive?
They go through a death of the skin-encapsulated ego. That's part of all the traditions. And you die to who you thought you were and are reborn in a larger sense. And then you have a choice. If you're a bodhisattva, you have a choice to not incarnate anymore. But you come back out of love for everything else. You come back to help other people realize the same realization. And, you know, at a smaller level, we're all bodhisattvas. You know, we all decide we're not going to close up and wall up. We're going to do the best we can for everybody. You know, these dynamics are all ambient in all of us to some extent. It's just how fully they're ambient determines the life course and the way we feel. Mary.
I'm still trying to understand this at the moment of birth surrender and that original ego death of the fetus. And
No, it's not ego death of the fetus. It's the birth of the false. This birth process gives something that was unified a sense of separateness.
Okay.
And the sense of separateness is necessary to operate in the world, but it's also fundamentally wrong in that we see ourselves as only separate rather than as interdependent.
I understand that, but I also thought I heard you say there's something about the surrendering to being born that you see God. Connect with that spiritual self so that when you have mystical experiences later in life, they have this resonance.
I think the surrender comes in the re-experiencing. I don't think that the child goes through a conscious process of surrender. It just happens. But in order to move through this dynamic again, one has to, at a certain point, face the fact that who you thought you were is going to go on all levels. And you're going to have to say, I accept this. And that's the passage. The only way out is through. Unfortunately. Macklin, and then we got to do this thing. Okay.
One more.
Yeah. Yeah, drug and alcohol abuse.
Yeah. Very prevalent in my family, young people, you know, I get very disturbed and worried about it. However, I hope you'll give some more comment on that one.
they used to say, Stan and his wife Christina, who's done a lot of work with addiction, having gone through one herself, and other people have said, drug and alcohol addiction is mistaken craving for God. It's an attempt to get out of yourself on a profound level. It's just the wrong strategy, which is why people that have got to the bottom have these amazing recoveries. That's what AA is all about. That's what many of these programs are all about, is when you hit bottom and you realize you can't do it, then you open to something larger, and then there's this realization of that which you were looking for. So the idea isn't to say you're bad for doing drugs. You're saying, look, you're just using the wrong strategy. Why don't you learn about what spiritual system attracts you the most? Go hang out with them for a little while and see if they have a better answer to the fact that your life is screwed up. You know, if you're way ahead of the game, if you realize that your skin-encapsulated ego doesn't work. So in a sense, those people are much closer to enlightenment than most of us, because we're hanging on for dear life and fighting our way through the world for dear life. They're good. They've given up, you know, but not completely. All right, I need to. Okay, Julie, and then I got to take you somewhere in 10 minutes here.
I sometimes get depressed and lonely, and I get when I'm alone, and sometimes, I used to friend to commit suicide.
All of us get depressed and lonely. The question is whether we give up, you know, whether we say, oh, I should just kill myself, or whether we say, if I'm depressed and lonely, maybe I ought to go to a CLL class and get with other people, because when I'm with other people, I'm not depressed and lonely.
Yeah.
So you...
doing the right thing. Look,
the best, when you get really in the deep poo-poo, don't quote me on that. The best advice I've heard two pieces of advice that come back at very, very dire times. One is swim toward the light. Swim toward the light, okay? And the second one, and it's funny that they would say swim, because that's the fluid in the birth canal, you know, so at that level, these metaphors all kind of come together. And the second one is from The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment, which I found on my shelf after, I won't tell you how many years, but I bought it in Palo Alto at the Seed Center bookstore back when it existed. Anyway, it said, and I've always remembered this, no matter what's happening with you, love as much as you can from wherever you are. Love as much as you can from wherever you are. All right. By the way, we haven't yet talked about the transpersonal levels, and Stan is going to say that birth complications do have some effect here, but I'll read that next time. I want to show you something that I found. On the internet, that kind of goes right along with this really amazingly well.
If I can figure out how to do this, cabinet PC. Why isn't... Oh, because you have to turn the PC on. Okay, let's go with that.
It will take a moment. This is an ancient system, as you can probably tell.
That was too bad. We don't really care about that. Thank you.
Yeah, you can do that. You can do that. Okay. Actually, you got to turn one on so I can see the keyboard. It's not backlit.
Process of switching to connecting computer to being
Okay. This is a little 10-minute video. Okay, Ani.
I was offered a position as associate professor of medicine and chief of scientific visualization at Yale University in the Department of Medicine. And my job was to write many of the algorithms in code for NASA to do virtual surgery in preparation for the astronauts going into deep space flight so they could be cut in robotic pods. One of the fascinating things about what we were actually working on is that we were seeing, using new kind of scanning technologies, things that just had never been seen before. I mean, not only in disease management, but also things that allowed us to see things about the body that just made you marvel. I remember one of the first times we were looking at collagen, and your entire body, everything, your hair, skin, bone, nails, everything is made of collagen, and it's a kind of a rope-like structure that twirls and swirls like this, and the only place that collagen changes its structure is in the corner of your eye. In your eye, it becomes a grid formation, and therefore it becomes transparent as opposed to opaque. So perfectly organized a structure, it was hard not to attribute divinity to it, because we kept on seeing this over and over and over again in different parts of the body. One of the opportunities I had was one person was working on a really interesting kind of micromagnetic resonance imaging machine with the NIH, and what we were going to do is scan.
Well, oh God, all right, so. Oh, it's loading, so...
Okay. A new project on the development of the fetus from conception to birth using these kinds of new technologies. So I wrote the algorithms in code, and he built the hardware. Paul Lauterbro then went on to win the Nobel Prize for inventing the MRI. I got the data. And I'm going to show you a sample of that piece from conception to birth.
This is actual images. This isn't a simulation. That's the egg. Thank you.
you can see, when you actually start working on this data, it's pretty spectacular. And as we kept on scanning more and more, you know, working on this project, looking at these two simple cells that have this kind of unbelievable machinery that will become the magic of you. And as we kept on working on this data, looking at small clusters of the body, these little, you know, pieces of tissue that were the trophoblast coming off of the blastocyst, all of a sudden burrowing itself into the side of the uterus, saying, you know, I'm here to stay, all of a sudden having a conversation and communications of the estrogens and progesterones, saying, you know, I'm here to stay, plant me, building this incredible trilinear fetus that becomes within 44 days something that you can recognize, and then at 9 weeks is really like a kind of a little human being. The marvel of this information, how do we actually have this biological mechanism inside our body to actually see this information? I'm going to show you something pretty unique. Here's a human heart at 25. It's just basically two strands. And like this magnificent origami, cells are developing at, you know, 1 million cells per second at 4 weeks as it's just folding on itself. Within 5 weeks, you can start to see the early atrium and the early ventricles. 6 weeks, these folds are now beginning with the papilla and the inside of the heart, actually being able to pull down each one of those valves in your heart until you get actually a mature heart, and then basically the development of the entire human body. The magic of the mechanisms inside each genetic structure, saying exactly where that nerve cell should go, the complexity of these, the mathematical models on how these things are indeed done, are beyond human comprehension. Even though I'm a mathematician, I look at this with a marvel of how do these instruction sets not make these mistakes as they build what is us. It's a mystery, it's magic, it's divinity. I mean, then when you start to take a look at an adult life, take a look at this little tuft of capillaries. It's just a tiny substructure, microscopic, but basically by the time you're 9 months and you've given birth, you have almost 60,000 miles of vessels inside your body. I mean, and only 1 mile is visible, 59,999 miles that are basically bringing nutrients and taking waste away. The complexity of building that within a single system is, again, beyond any comprehension of any existing mathematics today. And then instruction set from the brain to every other part of the body. Look at the complexity of the folding. Where is this intelligence of knowing that a fold could actually hold more information? So as you actually watch the baby's brain grow, and this is one of the things that we're doing right now, we're actually doing a longitudinal studies of actually scanning a baby's brains from the moment they're born every 6 months until they're 6 years old. We're going to be doing actually about 250 children, watching exactly how the gyri and the sulci of the brains fold to see how this magnificent develop actually turns into memories and the marvel that is us. And it's not just our own existence, but how does the woman's body understand to have genetic structure that not only builds her own, but then has the understanding that allows her to become a walking immunological cardiovascular, you know, system that basically is a mobile system that can actually nurture, treat this child with a kind of marvel that, you know, is beyond, again, our comprehension, the magic that is existence, that is us. Thank you.
Okay, so do we have the lights on again? Thank you. Let me see, we go like this. His name is Alexander Tsiaras. I'll write it down. Okay. I'll write it down on the board. So this is a TED Talk, and this is Alexander Tsiaras.
I thought the first letter was S.
Would he say, do you think, that a supercomputer is nowhere near as complex as a human body?
I have heard Rick Hansen, who made something from Rick Hansen in the winter. He wrote a book called Buddha's Brain. Anyway, I heard him talk, and he said that the human brain is by far the most complex structure in the universe currently.
Well, that we know of.
Yeah, yeah. Because the human brain is about 100 billion neurons, each connected on average to about 5,000 other neurons. So we're talking about 500 trillion connections. almost all of which are active all the time, and the number of times that the connections are used is typically between 5 and 50 times a second. So most of 500 trillion connections are being used at this moment, and every second being used between 5 and 50 times. Is that, wow. Rich, how's that sound to you? Does that sound reasonable? That's what they say. I mean, so that's pretty complex. What he's saying is, okay, we got a genetic, we got 3 billion base pairs in our genome. How does that amount of information get coded for by 3 billion base pairs? Yeah. But it's not just 3 billion base pairs. It's 3 billion base pairs interacting with all the other cells, 3 billion base pairs, and so turning stuff on and off in each cell. We just don't know how that works. Presumably, there's enough information in there to make a human being, but how it happens is beyond our comprehension. We don't understand how that information gets transferred. But it certainly is a prodigious feat of information technology inside us, much better than your Apple. other comments or questions in the next 2 minutes? Okay, Morty.
Do you think that this world we live in is really preschool, and the whole idea is just to simply go from here to where it really is, and this is just a playing ground?
You know, there's a million ways to answer that question. He's asking: Is this life we're living just a training ground, just a preschool for other levels? There's so many, a lot of philosophies say so, and spiritual systems say so. There's so many different ways to answer that question. I won't even try in 1 minute. But that's what a lot of folks say, is the illusion is that this is all there is. But as Stan Grof used to say, the cosmic joke is that we think that our consciousness is limited, that we came into existence with our birth and that we're going to end with our death. The joke is that there's no way out of consciousness. All right, let's see. Morty, one more time.
So it's kind of ridiculous, but...
No, it's the most profound question. Are you kidding? Everybody's trying to answer that question. All right, I think we have to break for today. I'll see if stuff has come up for you about this next week. And then I think I'm going to go a little further with this diagram next week. But I also have a bunch of other stuff to do. So maybe I'll spend some time on the step beyond the birth, the levels deeper than the birth and the perinatal experience. But I won't spend too much time on that because I also want to do something entirely different having to do with adult consciousness, which I think is really important for you to hear before the break. So those of you who would like to stay after, we do some art right now. It's absolutely delightful. Also, I want to remind you about the life stories. If you would write a page or so about your either a synopsis of your life or something about your life or something you want to contribute, we'll put them in the life story books, make 2 copies, give them to Donna, and we'll eventually have all our voices in that book. In those books. All right, we're dismissed for today.